WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Newspapers, the saying goes, are a daily miracle, and perhaps never has the expression been more apt than at the Times-Picayune in New Orleans. So wrote Douglas McCollum in the Columbia Journalism Review. As floodwaters rose during Katrina, the staff of the daily paper had to evacuate their building. For 3 days, they were unable to get out the newspaper, but they continued to publish on their website. The staff has been back in its building since October 10th. In an article about the paper in the LA Times, James Rainey wrote, "The Times-Picayune exposed poorly constructed levees, picked apart obtuse FEMA policies, debunked overblown claims of evacuation center violence, and traveled as far as the Netherlands and Japan to show how other communities have coped with flooding and disaster." My guest is the editor of the New Orleans Times-Picayune, Jim Amos. He's been with the paper since 1980, been editor since 1990, and grew up in New Orleans. The paper's offices are located near the low point of the bowl-shaped city. I asked Amos to describe what the neighborhood around the newspaper building looks like now.
Well, you can picture it most vividly if you imagine being in a city at night and all the urban life and lights that we're accustomed to in a city. In my city, if I look out my window after sundown, what I see is pitch black. I'm surrounded by a neighborhood that is essentially dead as of yet, that has no power and no human habitation for blocks and blocks. And 80% of the city of New Orleans is that way. We have become two cities, the 20% that was not flooded, which is up and vibrant again, the French Quarter, the Garden District, and parts that tourists for the most part know. But the 80% that were flooded are very slow to recover.
What about electricity? You say you look out and everything is dark around you. Is there no electricity in that part of the city, and do you have ample electricity?
Well, we have ample electricity, and so do a few larger companies around us. But the residential neighborhoods that are immediately adjacent to us are completely without it. And every night I drive home through blocks and blocks of utter darkness and desolation.
Does that mean no traffic lights either?
You're absolutely right. It means no traffic lights, stop signs at major intersections. In New Orleans, there's the etiquette of how to approach a major intersection has developed greatly over the past several months. And that's just one of the many changed conditions of life here now.
Do you feel safe going home? Do other people on your staff feel safe going home after dark?
Well, as long as one observes the stop signs, I think, yes, I feel safe. There's really nothing to fear except the darkness itself. There are no menacing humans around. So it's really a relatively crime-free and safe city at the moment. But in those dark parts, it's a bit grim.
Does the neighborhood that the paper's in still smell of the toxic waste that flooded New Orleans?
You know, the smell of flooded New Orleans, in my opinion, has been greatly exaggerated. Visually, the city has changed greatly, and in the flooded parts, it looks gray, and the vegetation is essentially dead. But I find there really is no great accompanying smell, and the toxicity also seems to be less than was initially feared.
At the newspaper, how have you divided the pages of the paper between, you know, more investigative reporting on what's happening and what happened, and just more practical information for readers, you know, about services that are opening or, you know, helping people who are still trying to locate lost loved ones?
Well, the investigative aspect permeates everything we do, whether it's on the business pages or on page one writing about levy breaches or writing about how federal money is being spent or whether the levy boards are accountable for the way in which they manage their business. As for the practical aspects, and there's so many of them, we devote page after page to such eclectic items as groups of citizens meeting, neighborhood organizations getting together, when various schools will reopen, and questions about insurance, questions about levy reconstruction and the pace of it. Those really take up quite a bit of space in our paper these days.
How do you stay in business now? The circulation for the actual paper part of the newspaper must be down because so few people are living in New Orleans. A lot of businesses that would advertise aren't in New Orleans now either. So how are you getting enough money to actually stay in publication?
Well, New Orleans has actually, the metro area of New Orleans has rebounded more strongly than I think some national reports might suggest. Already in the city of New Orleans alone, we have, by some estimates, as many as 140,000, 150,000 inhabitants. And in the suburban parishes surrounding New Orleans, we're almost back to 90%. So, and the newspaper's heft and the newspaper's degree of advertising reflects that. So I think we and the community have come back far more strongly and more vitally than anyone, including ourselves, would have believed in those dark days of September.
My guest is Jim Amos. He's the editor of the New Orleans Times-Picayune. One of the editorials that you wrote for the paper basically said that there are a lot of Byzantine and wasteful political structures in New Orleans, and this is a good opportunity to get rid of them. What kind of cleanup are you hoping that the hurricane will end up inadvertently creating in government?
Well, one of the most wasteful agencies, interestingly enough, is the agency that controls the local end of levee maintenance and levee inspection, the so-called levee boards. In New Orleans alone, each parish, and in some cases one parish, has more than one levee board. And these levee boards are not coordinated with each other. They have different responses when a hurricane comes. And on top of that, they have other duties that have nothing to do with hurricane protections and levees, such as maintaining a police force that hardly ever makes any arrests, mowing grass in odd lots that they happen to own. It's absolutely vital that Louisiana muster the political resolve to unify these agencies so that they're stripped of all these adjunct duties that have nothing to do with levee protection. They need to act as one coordinated force that has one coordinated voice.
There's been a lot of blame passed around between city, state, and federal officials and elected leaders about who was responsible for the disaster in New Orleans. And I'm wondering if you and the editorial board has reached any conclusions of who made the biggest blunders.
I think local and federal and state authorities have been blamed in many cases for the wrong things. For example, the evacuation of the city of New Orleans was a huge success, and yet it is being described over and over again as a huge fiasco. But any city that can empty itself of 80% of its population with 48 hours notice, which is about what we had after the storm turned, I think can be proud of having achieved a remarkable feat. The bungling occurred, in my view, in the days immediately after, when the people who remained were just not provided for and were grouped together in horrible, almost animalistic conditions that were just subhuman. And that is a blame that I think local authorities have to shoulder and have to do something about in the future.
You know, a lot of people are saying that a lot of the horrible conditions, that people were able to get away with that because most of the people who were in the Superdome and at the convention center were African American, and they were poor. And yet, the mayor of the city is African American himself, so, I mean, you wouldn't accuse him of being insensitive to the issue of race. So how do you make that add up?
Well, I think the premise is perhaps ill-founded. The conditions were horrific. I think they would have been horrific regardless of who was in those shelters, and they were so because of poor planning, because of lack of coordination. On the part of the federal government, there was an almost criminal negligence in speedily coming to the aid of a city. I mean, this was the greatest urban natural disaster in the history of this country, and the response was not commensurate. The response was pathetic.
Do you feel like you have a sense yet of what the rebuilt New Orleans might look like in terms of how the city will physically look different and how the makeup of the city will be different? The residents, will the class and race and ethnic population remain similar to what it was?
You know, I think I start with the belief that New Orleans, and maybe New Orleans is different from most cities in this regard, that New Orleans has a really fierce pull and hold on its citizens. And even those people who swore in September that they would never come back are now feeling that pull and finding it very hard to resist. And I think that attraction of the city for its citizens knows no class bounds or racial bounds, and that what we'll end up with is a racial and ethnic mix. It's pretty much what it was before Katrina, but I do think that it'll be a while before we rebound to the size that we were. I think we'll be a smaller city for some time to come, and I hope in many ways a better city because of the various institutional reforms that I think will take place.
I would imagine that in New Orleans right now, there's a lot of people coming in who want to help, but maybe also a lot of people coming in who want to make a quick buck. Do you see a lot of both right now?
I saw both very vividly illustrated yesterday as I was gardening outside my house, mostly the positive. I can't tell you how many neighbors stopped to admire just the progress of what I was doing. One lady said, "Oh, you're trying to say welcome home," and somebody else walked by with a camera and wanted to take a picture of me next to a freshly planted bed of pansies. And on the other hand, about every 10 minutes, a pickup truck would stop by to pick up garbage bags filled with yard debris. And it dawned on me that the reason for the frequent pickups is that they get paid by the load, and so they're making a killing on picking up readily available garbage bags. And you see that phenomenon in car towing and all the other little trash removal tasks that need to be attended to in our city.
But is that helping, though? Is that helping set a fire under people to remove debris?
Well, it's helping in that it's occurring faster than it would under any ordinary circumstance. I mean, there are literally mountains of debris that have disappeared from parts of the city as a result of this kind of action. But it has probably cost more than it need cost because of multiple layers of contracting and just the kind of wages that you have to pay people to do this work under these circumstances.
My guest is Jim Amos, editor of the New Orleans Times-Picayune. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jim Amos, editor of the New Orleans Times-Picayune. Just after Hurricane Katrina, Amos and his staff had to evacuate their offices and head for dry land. Were you in on the meeting that decided when it was time to go?
Yes, it was Tuesday morning. The storm had passed on Monday, and on Monday night, the winds had pretty much died down, but strangely enough, the water continued to inch up, and we found out through our reporters and photographers that the levees had been breached. But you know, we're far enough away from those levees that it seemed still a little far-fetched that it would reach us. Well, when we woke up on Tuesday morning, it became obvious that we were going to be inundated just as much as anybody else, and the water was rising about an inch every 7 minutes. We sat down as a group of editors and talked about this. And at that moment, our publisher stuck his head in my door as well. And as a group, we concluded that we had to not only get out, but we had to get out within the next half hour.
How did you do it?
Well, we ran through the building of our newspaper. People were still asleep in their sleeping bags. People were having breakfast in our cafeteria. People were already beginning to work. And we just ran through the building shouting, get out, get out, go to the loading dock. And at the loading dock, where normally newspapers are shipped out for delivery, we started shipping out people for delivery to we did not know where. In the backs of our delivery trucks. We just pulled up a dozen or so newspaper delivery trucks and started moving people into the backs of them.
So if you didn't know where they were going to go, where did the trucks start driving?
Well, we knew that the first order of business was to get to dry land. And dry land was right in front of us on the interstate that borders our building. But to get to it, we had to go through about a mile of heavily flooded service road. We just had that one goal at first, get out of this flooded area of the service road, get onto the interstate, and then figure out what next. We knew that the only exit from the city at that point was across the Mississippi River Bridge, which is about 2 miles from our plant. It wasn't until we had crossed the Mississippi River and gotten to the dry other side that we parked our vehicles and started figuring out what next.
Yeah, and what I mean, how did you figure out where you could go? You had so many people, it's a big operation.
Well, you know, as newspaper people, we have this instinct about not missing a day of publication. And the first thing that we decided is we have to have a newspaper tonight. And then we concluded we have to send some reporters and photographers back into that city to report on it, and so that we will have a paper tonight. So we gave a group of about 15, 16 volunteers one of the trucks. They headed back into the city, and then we had to decide where we were going to produce this newspaper and how we would set up a temporary newsroom.
And where did you set it up?
Well, we went to a small town in Louisiana, Houma, a New York Times owned newspaper that we've been in contact with over the years, and they helped us produce the first printed editions of the paper in the coming days, and then the rest of us, not involved in production and design, drove on to Baton Rouge, arrived there that Tuesday night, and through some incredibly generous help from the dean of the LSU Journalism School, set up shop at the university in the journalism classrooms and produce the newspaper from there.
Has this experience made you rethink the role of a newspaper in the life of a city?
This experience has affirmed for me the importance that a newspaper can have for its readers, because a newspaper has the resources to know its own backyard and does indeed know it because of years of having reported on it. And there's really no substitute, and I don't mean to sound arrogant about it, but there's no substitute for that intimate knowledge of people's neighborhoods, of people's communities, and what's running and what isn't, and why what happened. There's no substitute for a hometown newspaper reporting in that way. And anecdotally, I would say our readers have let us know that and have told us in various ways how much it meant to them to have that kind of local reporting on a very intense and constant level, both inform them and also sustain their spirits.
The Times-Picayune now has a section that's devoted to Mardi Gras. You know, in Philadelphia, being at this far distance, it seems like the plans to proceed with Mardi Gras are a little controversial. From what I've been reading, some people think it's an inappropriate time to start partying, whereas a lot of people think that it's a perfect time to have Mardi Gras and bring people back into the city and bring a sense of joy back to the city, in a sense that the city can carry on. Have you written any editorials about Mardi Gras?
Yes, we have. I believe, that Mardi Gras is a community celebration, not what it is largely portrayed as on national TV, a sort of a party of college students in the French Quarter. It's a city celebration that encompasses all the neighborhoods of this city and involves people in not only partying, but also putting on these elaborate parades and just fantastic music by local high school bands. And it is an expression of the spirit of this city. And without it, we believe that it would be a capitulation of something that's so essential to what New Orleans is about.
Will you be there on Mardi Gras days?
Absolutely. I plan to be in town for the 8-day duration of the celebration and to partake in it fully, as I have every year.
Costume and all? Mask?
We mask on Fat Tuesday, and we encourage all our readers to do likewise.
Thank you very much for talking with us, and good luck to you and your paper.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Jim Amos is the editor of the New Orleans Times-Picayune. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.